Welcome to It's All Politics from NPR News. I'm Ken Rudin.
And I'm Linda Wertheimer, filling in for Ron Elving, as if such a thing could be done.
Well, actually, Ron is in Youngstown, Ohio this week. He's welcoming home Jim Trafficant from prison. Ron is wearing his hairpiece and polyester suits, and it should be
and
a very nice time.
I would hope a sweatshirt that says, Welcome Home, Jimbo.
Yeah, I saw that.
Which I understand we're on
And sale. I also hear that Colonel Gaddafi is going to be there for the greeting him as well, that there's a rumor that I'm starting that is out there. But the most important story, I guess, is the news that President Obama will once again rally the American people behind his or some kind of health care plan.
Well, the second part of that, it seems to me, is the relevant part, the health care plan. I mean, he makes wonderful speeches. We know that. But I think this is not all about oratory. I mean, I remember that in October, before the election year began, he was famous for making beautiful speeches. But even people who were dying to support him were saying, okay, what else? And I think he's having another one of those moments. And he needs, rather than soaring oratory, he needs some feet planted firmly in a plan.
It's my impression that what President Obama was very conscious of not repeating was the Clinton's way of my way or the highway of 1993, 1994. So he stayed out, let Congress do it. But Congress is not doing well. And we saw when Congress left town for the month of August, a lot of misinformation, a lot of anger, a lot of shouting took over. So obviously there's a lot of feeling that the president should reassert or at least assert himself in this debate by saying, look, here's what I want, here's what I don't want, and let's do something.
One of the things that's going on here is that the president basically has done everything he can through his surrogates in the Hill to try to give the Republicans a reason to become engaged in this thing, to try to produce a bill in the Senate that some of them could support, that kind of thing. And that is, it just has not worked at all. Because
how many Republicans do you think are on board so far? Maybe one?
So at some point, he just simply has to bail on that, and maybe that will be what happens.
They may have the votes, to certainly in the House, perhaps in the Senate, to pass it with no Republican votes. Is that going to be the kind of health care overhaul that, one, President Obama envisioned, and, two, that the country needs?
One, no, not what he envisioned. Two, not clear that it will be what the country needs. But the thing is that the proof of the pudding is in the doing. And when he, you know, he's three more years. And if it passes and they start implementing it, then people will make a judgment on how it turned out.
That's a very good point, because everybody's talking about that unhappiness or uncertainty about health care overhaul is one of the reasons why President Obama's numbers have gone down. But, of course, if there is a passage of anything, incremental or not, one expects that the Democrats and the president's numbers would go up.
I would think so. And the big risk is maybe they're risking some Democratic seats, some shaky Democratic seats in the House or the Senate. But they have some time.
Who's President Obama's audience next Wednesday? It's obviously not the American people. I suspect it's not the American people, and it may not even be the Republicans. It may be just getting his own party in order.
Standing up there and looking as tough as he can and trying to be as affirmative as he can be about doing health care to try to, you know, sort of shift the debate a little bit.
We always like to refer back to the Bill Clinton speech before a joint session of Congress in September of 1993, when this was the Clinton big issue. Within a year, the plan was dead.
I do think there is a strong impetus to do something here. There was, and it's also in the Clinton years, but I think it's stronger now. So if I were advising them or trying to, you know, create a strategy for them, which I'm not, I would suggest that one possibility that might work for the Obamas is for one House to do something that has a public option in it, the House, that leans to the liberal side, and the Senate to do whatever it can manage to pass. You know, everybody kind of gets out of there with some skin intact. And then they finally work the bill out behind closed doors, which with a bill like this is what you ultimately have to do.
Although the feeling is that once it goes to conference committee, it will be the Senate version that probably went out, the more conservative version. And then you have the liberals who maybe had a nice victory in the House, but it would be very short-lived.
You give them something, but I don't know what you do about that. But, you know, we're not going to see a health bill that is written in stone here. If something's not working, they can change it. It's not permanent, it's like everything else that the Congress passes. They, you know, they get plenty of do-overs.
One expected and yet unfortunate calculations for the Democrats is they no longer have the 60 votes needed in the Senate. Of course, that's because of the August 25th passing of Senator Edward Kennedy. Not unexpected, but again, they lose that so-called guaranteed 60th vote. And now there's a lot of weird things going on in trying to replace him in Massachusetts.
Massachusetts has this law that says that you can't appoint somebody to replace a senator.
Wait, I thought they used to have that law.
You know, they made some expedient decisions at one point and changed it. And what they're thinking about now is making expedient decision to change it back so that they can appoint somebody at least long enough for Massachusetts to have a vote on the health care debate. And it would be a terrible kind of irony if President Obama's health care plan, something that Senator Kennedy fought for, doesn't pass because Senator Kennedy isn't there.
Speaking of Kennedy, and we are talking about Kennedy, there is a lot of waiting for a Kennedy to run for the Senate or to announce some kind of plans. Vicky Kennedy, his widow, has basically told everybody, including the governor, that she's not interested. Less certain is what the plans are of Joseph Kennedy II, the former congressman, may have in mind.
I think he clearly does want it. The Kennedy sons, inconveniently, do not live in Massachusetts. So that makes it difficult, although not impossible, for them to run.
As lifelong New Yorker Hillary Clinton learned, right?
Indeed. But I think, you know, I wouldn't count Victoria Reggie Kennedy out of this. I think that she has demonstrated that she has considerable political talent. She's advised her husband. They were very much a team. And
she apparently turned his whole life around.
Yeah, and you watch the way she orchestrated the funeral, all the tremendous number, I mean, 85 Kennedys walking into that church. I think that they're going to put some pressure on her. And she would be, that would be the position you would want to be in, I think. You wouldn't want to be the widow saying, I'll do it. Let me do it. You'd want to be the widow who says, no, I wouldn't even think of it. I can't think of it. And then they all beg you, please, please think of it. And then you graciously say, well, maybe I'll think of it.
Assuming the Massachusetts state legislature comes back in September and changes the law and allows Governor Patrick to name an interim appointment, probably the thing that would take most pressure off Patrick is to name somebody like a Vicky Kennedy, because otherwise, if you pick somebody else, I mean, there are like 10 other folks around who would desperately want this seat, have been looking at the seat for the longest time. This week, the state attorney general, Martha Coakley, announced that she will run. But, you know, you have former Congressman Marty Meehan, you had Ed Markey, you have Michael Capuano, you have Stephen Lynch. You have all these congressmen basically waiting, you know, waiting to see what the Kennedys do.
And they've been in waiting for a long time.
Exactly.
It's one of the ways in which state politicians kind of calm down the ravening ambitions that start to get uncomfortable and make everybody think that this whole business is going to turn into a mess, is to get the widow out there.
Ted Kennedy, in his memoir, is being published, I guess, later this month. Some excerpts were in this week's New York Times. A lot of interesting introspection, reflection on Chappaquiddick.
Well, the Chappaquiddick things are, of course, the headlines that where he talks about how his behavior was inexcusable. But I think we know a lot about Chappaquiddick. I was more interested in some of the kind of private family stuff that was alluded to in the Times article.
He talks about his excessive drinking, certainly in the wake of Bobby Kennedy's assassination and after his divorce from Joan Kennedy in 1982, which basically culminated in the event in Florida with William Kennedy Smith, his nephew, and the rape charges against William Kennedy Smith. One thing I read that interests me, too, is that, and I guess we all speculated on this, too, that one of the reasons Ted Kennedy was not in a position to defend Anita Hill against Clarence Thomas during that
confirmation.
In 1991 is the fact that Kennedy himself was just as guilty, perhaps, if indeed Clarence Thomas was.
I think that's incredibly interesting. And there, too, he blames himself. He says that he was at fault and should not have done it and so forth. But he also says that he thinks that his reputation as a womanizing drunk, that was overstated also.
Well, that's true about Ron Elving as well, but, you know, the chasing women and drinking.
But the part that I'm really interested in is the idea of what happened after his brother was killed. What happened in the family? He writes about Robert Kennedy being so destroyed by the president's death that they really feared for his own health and his mental health.
Bobby's health.
And that after Bobby Kennedy died, the terrible toll that took on Teddy, that he just sort of left. He was not in the Senate for several months after that happened. And he talks about all that. And I don't know. You know, we all lived through that period. And it was a terrible time. And I think that, you know, I'm still interested.
I still picture Bobby Kennedy standing at the platform at the 64 convention, which is just, you know, less than a year after JFK was killed. And God knows what was going through his mind, but obviously shock and depression and sorrow. And then you see Ted Kennedy in Chicago in 68 when everybody's saying, please run, you know, we need you to run. And I'm sure running for president was the last thing Ted Kennedy thought of in 68, just 2 months after Bobby was shot.
I thought that there was an interesting quote that the Times included in their coverage where they said that when he considered the things that his brothers had achieved before he was even out of childhood, that he felt that his whole life had been a lifetime of catch-up.
And you think of what he accomplished nearly 47 years in the Senate, far more, when you think of it, than either of his two brothers in public life.
Yeah.
Another thing that seems slightly inconceivable was a New York Post headline this week that announced that Eliot Spitzer, you remember him? The New York Post, by the way, calls him...
I vaguely remember him.
The hooker-happy Democrat, that's how they call him, is talking about perhaps running for either a state controller or maybe challenging Kirsten Gillibrand for the Senate seat. I think the story is insane and not going to happen, but it's...
Well...
There it was on the front page of that. Look, who are we to argue with the New York Post?
Indeed. I do think if Mr. Spitzer is actually contemplating that and talking to anybody in any sort of serious way about it, then he is seriously delusional. But, you know, you might just take a wild leap and think perhaps the Post is working on a little inoculation here. Let's bring this up. Let's shoot this down. Let's get everybody talking about it, and we'll be sure it's not going to happen.
One thing under the subject of what could he have been thinking, this 1989 thesis of Bob McDonnell, the Republican running for governor of Virginia, who seemed, at least in 1989, seemed to have views that were several centuries old.
Now, for a politician, it's an awkward thing to do, to try to disavow a thesis that you write, which is entitled The Republican Party's Vision for the Family, the Compelling Issue for the Decade. I mean, that's certainly true, that family was the big issue of the 90s for the Republicans. And in that, he finds, among other things, that for mothers to work is detrimental to the family. And I don't see how he backs off this thing, frankly. I don't see how. I mean, it was the 90s. He's backing off the 90s. It's not that far away.
It was a youthful indiscretion. He was 34. But, I mean, and he says he's moderated his views on a lot of things. But, of course, a lot of people who followed his campaigns, his career in the state legislature, say that he was a very, very conservative Republican lawmaker. Virginia and New Jersey were two states that the Republicans were counting on as part of their comeback. And Bob McDonnell had, like, a double-digit lead over Cree Deeds. Now, that number has been halved in the wake of the Washington Post reporting about this thesis. But can the Democrats capitalize on it? That's the question.
Well, they've got ads out. The governor has been talking. There are all kinds of efforts being made to see to it that Virginians never forget. As I say, I don't think you can back away from something that happened as recently as that. And backing away from it, you know, and is a something that angers the base, who basically agrees with him. So I think he could be in trouble here. His best shot is that there is some sort of a backlash going on in Virginia. I mean, Virginia went for Obama, and that was historic. And maybe they're thinking, well, I don't know, maybe we ought to. And a little bounce back from that, I think, is the best shot McDonnell has, and he's kind of messed it up. I'd say this is one of the good reasons why people who are interested in politics should major in English literature, because bringing your thesis back to haunt you if you majored in English literature, not going to happen.
Another Republican in trouble, although not running for office, it seems, is our friend Mark Sanford in South Carolina.
Yeah.
And it's not even the Democrats who are out to get him. It's Republicans who said, enough is enough. It's time for you to go. And yet it doesn't look like he's going anywhere.
They had a caucus in Myrtle Beach, where I'm sure they behaved extremely well. And I get the feeling that they would really like this to happen, but they really don't want to do it themselves. They want him to resign. And he shows no signs of that.
You know why, by the way? Because when he came back from Argentina, they said he was too pompous. Thank you. I've been saving that joke for... I won't use that joke again, but I thought I'd say that. One disgraceful note, because this has never happened in American politics, Charlie Crist, the governor of Florida, who would love to be Senator Crist, and he has an opportunity now that Mel Martinez is retiring. Charlie Crist named his former chief of staff, George Lemieux, to succeed Martinez, who's resigning from the Senate this month. Lemieux, a lot of Democrats said this is cronyism at its worst.
Mr. Lemieux had gone to work for a law firm and appeared to be making millions, according to the Democrats, by helping people to meet with the governor and essentially to trade on his friendship with Charlie Crist.
Oh, Crist Almighty, as we call him. That's right.
I think that... But this is, you know, as you say, this is not unusual. This is a placeholding senator.
Well, that's what's so funny about it, because the Democrats went ballistic saying, you know, it's cronyism. How do you do this? Meanwhile, let's remind some people what happened in Delaware not too long ago when Joe Biden left the Senate to become vice president. They picked his former chief of staff, Ted Kaufman, to become a senator as a placeholder for Beau Biden to run in 2010. So it's a little disingenuous when the Democrats will complain about.
Basically, it's a lot disingenuous. There are some people who are interested in running against the governor. Clay Shaw, you know, who is the Republican from Fort Lauderdale, he's always been mentioned as somebody who would be a great Republican senator from the state.
Oh, yeah, they had at least three or four former members of Congress, state office holders. He could have picked a Hispanic to replace him. Mel Martinez was the only Latino Republican senator, and it could have helped with Latino voters. And especially because in next year's primary, Charlie Crist is running against Marco Rubio, who is Cuban-born, very conservative.
You know what I keep wondering about this is that as the president's popularity dips, especially in states like Florida and Virginia, which were, you know, close states for him, you know, maybe Mel Martinez made a mistake. Maybe he didn't need to leave.
So Mel Martinez is leaving the Senate after one term. Somebody leaving the Supreme Court after several terms, possibly, at least according to the rumor mill, is John Paul Stevens.
And that's based on the fact that for the 2010 term, he's only hired one clerk. And that's the limit for retired justices. Each of them can have one clerk. But he usually has four. And so that's what has started the speculation, is the notion that he's not bringing on a full brace of clerks. But he's, you know, he's getting way up in years.
He's 89 years old.
One of the longest-serving justices ever.
Appointed by?
You go ahead.
President Ford.
Thank you.
Yeah. Okay.
But it doesn't change anything if he does leave now.
I mean, ultimately, if you're replacing David Souter with Sonia Sotomayor and you're replacing John Paul Stevens with another liberal, there is no earth-shaking World War III end-of-the-world scenario in the confirmation fight.
The only thing that would make that happen would be if Justice Kennedy, Justice Thomas, Justice Scalia, one of the conservative justices, or one of the swing justices, as Justice Kennedy is referred to, that would change the voting on the court.
And until that happens, that's it for this week's political podcast.
You can follow NPR's political coverage at npr.org/politics.
I'm Ken Rudin.
And I'm Linda Wertheimer.
Join us again next week for Ron Elving's triumphant return from Polyester and Jim Trafficant to It's All Politics from NPR.
The old hometown looks the same as I step down from the train. And there to meet me is my mama and papa. Down the road I look, and there runs Mary, hair of gold and lips like cherries. It's good to touch the green, green grass of home.